and paper.
Welcome to episode 122 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. You can also find the show notes for this episode at HelenHebertStudio.com/podcast. Today I'm talking with Claire Van Vliet, a printmaker and typographer who founded Janus Press in San Diego, California in 1955. Van Vliet received a MacArthur Genius Grant in 1989 and is known for her innovative use of pigmented pulp to create images and editions for art books, prints, and broadsides. Van Vliet has exhibited and lectured around the world in universities and museums. Her next exhibition is Paperworks, Claire Van Vliet, which will be on view at the Boston Athenaeum from September 10th through December 30th, 2024. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Claire Van Vliet, welcome to Paper Talk. Such an honor to have you, and I'm looking forward to talking to you about your long career with paper. Tell me about how you got into paper.
Well, one of the first things I was concerned about with paper was its longevity. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of the papers that we were using for printmaking, like Reeves and Arsh, mold-vein papers. Granted, they were theoretically all cotton, though there was a period there where they introduced some polyester towards the end of the 70s, which I think printmakers were loud enough about that they stopped doing it. But that longevity of the paper came about for me because of starting the Janus Press in 1955. By the mid-70s, and early 80s, I had noticed that, particularly the Reeves paper that I had printed quite a few books on, was yellowing.
Mm.
And even though they were books, they were yellowing.
Wow.
So I started to get really concerned about the longevity of the paper. And also that was a feeling of responsibility to my customers as well, that they shouldn't have to pay at that time, say $100 for a book. We're talking mm-hmm. the dark ages here. that was going to, in 20 years, turn yellow on them.
Right.
So I deacidified a lot of my early prints that I still had. We had a big deacidification program going here.
Oh.
And so I started to also think about the colors in paper and how acidic they were and how much they might be problematic. So I basically got into hand paper making through a wonderful grant from the literature program of the National Endowment for the Arts. And I had asked a number of paper conservators of where I might be able to get paper that was colored, that was both light fast and that was archival.
Ah, okay.
And in speaking with the librarian at the Newberry Library, he said, they're working on that at Twin Rocker.
Mm.
And I had gotten a grant to do Aura of Hayden Carruth's, and I had wanted to have both the wide mountain image, which I thought I would be ending up making, having to attach a lot of smaller pieces to make the wide book. It's 48 inches wide. But he told me about Twin Rocker. So I wrote to Twin Rocker, and Kathy is a printmaker. She trained as a lithography printmaker and an edition printer, and I'm a printmaker. And so we really clicked because we're both interested in multiples.
Right.
And so I had talked to a couple of other paper makers, but they were only interested in one-offs. So I went to Twin Rocker, and that's where I started making paper.
Okay.
And that was in December 1976.
And Twin Rocker started just a couple years before that, maybe?
In California, and then they moved to Howie's grandparents' farm in Brookston, in Indiana, and they were living in a trailer, and the paper making facility was basically like a large garage.
Right. And so, tell me a little bit about that. Was that book pulp painted? And was Kathy already doing that,
or
you developed
this
all together?
It was not pulp painted.
Okay, it was colored sheets.
Cowie made a deco that had a lot of metal separations in it.
Okay, so you can make...
Essentially, it was poured.
Okay.
But then, because it was 4 feet long, so it was... Susan Hostetler and Bill Hodson and Kathy and Howie all together. Once the dam was removed, we had to shake it a bit so it would hold together.
Okay.
And they did. And we made 50 copies. But the paper back then, they hadn't gotten muslin yet. They were still working with linters.
Okay.
But by the next year, when I went back in to make Midi, they were working more with muslin. And then in 1980, when I went to make the Dream of the Dirty Woman, and a year later or 2 years later to make January Hours, they were making wonderful pulp. And in those cases, I could print on the image. And that was something that I was very interested in doing, is having the paper be part of both the illustration or the imagery and the poetry all together. So with the Dream of the Dirty Woman, Kathy dipped the sheets and I decorated them basically with squeeze bottles. That one.
Is that what you're using the muslin for, the pulp painting? Or was the muslin for the base sheet also?
Overbeaten, because in that one I had planned to print relief prints on top. And so I wanted the paper to integrate with the relief print.
Mm.
And then the next time I went, which was for Lilac Wind, I keep calling it January Hours because that was the first title we gave it. And that one, the imagery was made and the prints were made just on the text was just on the snow at the bottom. So it was we were kind of moving along and working out. And I was pretty amazed because I've been doing a lot of small watercolors of clouds, and then I had been working with printers in Denmark to do color lithographs, which I'd had to use rubbing ink for the clouds. And then all of a sudden, with the pulp, the clouds just kind of made
Right.
themselves.
Wow.
And it was just fabulous.
Yeah.
But in between all of this going on, right after my first trip there in 76, Howie showed me how to make a dishpan paper.
Uh-huh.
And so I was the dishpan paper mill. And then he and Kathy came out here, and I think this is how it happened. They came out to make have a kind of workshop at the Steinauer Press, which is not far from me.
Okay.
About an hour's drive
mm-hmm.
Here in Vermont. And so I think Rocky Steinauer was pretty interested in what was going on and invited them, and they stayed with me. And they brought a small little press with them, paper press,
okay,
which they left behind for me. And which, after I started working with Katie and Bernie and got a big paper press, one of Howie's paper presses, I let Katie and Bernie have that for also for school demonstrations and for workshops. And
okay.
Katie's bringing that press back to me now, because at 90, it's not so easy for me to make paper all by myself. So I'll be making smaller sheets, just 12 by 16, that I can do in my giant sink all by myself. So that'll be fun.
Yeah, so you're referring to Katie McGregor and Bernie
Vanzani, yep.
Who live in Maine. They're a little closer than Twin Rocker.
Well,
Or
Twin
how did
Rocker,
you get connected to them? Were they apprentices when you were down at Twin
yes,
Rocker? Okay.
Yes,
yeah
yes. First, Bernie
okay.
Was there, I believe, when I was making Dream of the Dirty Woman. And then when I went back to make Lilac Wind, Katie had joined the crew as well. And that's, and she was so involved with the making really intense colors, because they were doing these papers for Joe Good to shoot.
Oh.
Not my idea that you make the paper with a
with a
pistol.
gun. Okay.
It was a New York commission.
Right.
So they, I believe it was in 84, Katie and Bernie moved to Whiting, Maine, and basically built their house, and the living and the shop were all in one. And we were pretty primitive, but it was fine. And so in 85, I started going there because I could drive there. It's a 7-hour drive.
Okay.
It's just due east, 350 miles. And so that made it a lot easier. And then also I was able to, after going there a couple of times, I built my own drawing boxes, so I would bring back the pressed images and pressed book papers or whatever, or broadsides, whatever we had been doing, and I would dry them here, because I could leave in the morning, get here in the afternoon, spend the night loading up the dryers, and that those dryers really worked very, very well. Part of the reason that we could get good dryers was that it was a place called Archivart, which is going back a ways, started making acid-free corrugated.
Right.
So that's really what allowed us to make these wonderful dryers. As I think, I mean, I never saw the dryer at Twin Rocker, but I don't think was built that way. And I think that people are pretty much mum about what the dryer always was.
Yeah, I've heard that. So you weren't privy to seeing the dryer. Yeah, okay.
I based it on, there was a dryer made, a metal box that was similar to my dryer, which of course Hand Paper Making published the plans for.
Mm-hmm.
That was made out of metal that Kodak made.
Oh.
And so it wasn't very big, but it gave me the idea of how to do it.
Right, right.
And so I just made everything predicated on being able to accommodate a 22 by 30 sheet of paper. But Bernie and Katie could make this 33 by 44. They had this big mold. It would used to take three of us to make a sheet of paper. They would be manning it, and I would pull the tablecloth from the decal box.
That's
how I got to make all those big pulp paintings that are 33 by 44.
Right.
Yeah, but anyway, I went back and forth to Katie and Bernie's quite a bit. I mean, we did the bulk of the of my paper making was done with them, and then I can't remember. It was when we did. It was over New Year's, so it'd be right about this time. Might have been 86. I'd have to look up and see when the Ray Carver broadside was made. Bernie came and we finished off the paper studio here, and he brought pulp and we made that broadside together here in at Janus.
And what was the reason? Did you just want to have a full studio at Janus?
Yes, once I realized we could use the decal boxes. That it
for
would make
pouring larger sheets rather than having to pull them.
Yes. I mean, I do have a big vat now and all of that. We can do everything big, but it was kind of amazing that we did that. It was right in the winter time. I probably have some pictures of that. Anyway, it was very generous of Bernie to come. And then slowly it sort of segued with a number of the paper projects with Katie. She came here with help. In a way, it was easier because then it went right into the dryer.
Right.
And also, it didn't interfere with anything else that was going on in her shop. And, oh my goodness, she just does know how to put the color in the paper.
Yeah.
It's just in the pulp. It's right. Incredible.
Right.
I mean, just amazing. And so forth, a number of things, particularly the Silences Between, which I think was 2010. And then I think that was the last cover we made here in a big edition, but she did come other times and we did other projects. And I also got very interested in integrating my lithographs because I have a stone lithography workshop as well, and integrating my lithographs because a lot of them are rock forms. And it always seemed a little bit too hard to integrate a sky into these. So I started pulp painting just with black. And so I've done a lot of that. And collaged those into lithographs. I'm very interested in using the handmade paper in traditional printmaking techniques. And at Magnolia Editions, we printed lithographs and etchings on top of some of their paper that we pulp painted. And it just is, paper is just, particularly for atmospheric things, it's so amazing. It's like the ultimate pointillism. Because it's like you're actually, these pigments, because I've done a lot of painting too. I mean, watercolors mainly. I'm not an oil painter. But the mixing of color easily gets muddy. But when you mix, say, yellow and gray in the pulp, it does the same thing as it does in the sky. It doesn't turn to mud. It turns to that strange ethereal yellow that you often see in the sky. And the same thing with, and that's why the bulk of my pulp paintings are skyscapes.
Talk a little more about that. You mentioned that Katie's good with color. Did you always have someone making colors for you, or do you do that? Have you done that as
I
well?
did it myself
Okay.
in the beginning, and with the pigments that either came from Twin Rocker or from Carriage House. And I have retention aid, but I always bought the pulp. I don't have a beater. That's why I don't think of myself as a paper maker, but as kind of a paper decorator. Because I think if you're not beating the pulp, you're not really a paper maker in terms of having that as a title. And so I've always bought my pulp either from Katie and Bernie or from Twin Rocker.
Okay. And what is the pulp made from? So you mentioned the muslin. What about
Ideally, I like it when it's made out of muslin. But now apparently everybody's having trouble. A German company has bought Cheney, and they are not supplying Americans with the half stuff now.
okay,
It's
so
all
it's the
from
Cheney
Germany.
half stuff that is made from muslin. All right. Yeah. Yeah. Can you, I'd love to hear you talk about pulp painting a landscape and the water and just a little bit of about how those clouds form. And maybe are you looking at the sky every day? Do you spend a certain amount of
Well,
time?
where I live, I have a rising field that meets the sky. And where I live also is the second most cloudy place in the United States. Cloudiest being out there in Washington and Oregon. But up here on this high plateau that I live on, high for the East Coast, of course. It's not even baseline for where you are. The clouds are amazing. And so for 50 odd years, I've been watching the clouds. And the reason I moved here was because of the clouds. I had encountered clouds, and then that had moved me towards color when I was in Denmark. And somehow coming, I was in Jutland, and the clouds change a tremendous amount there every day because they're coming off the North Sea, which is pretty windy. And so, in fact, it drives people crazy. It's so windy. But it's, yeah, and when I saw this land, I said, okay, this feels right. And I had moved around a tremendous amount, even as a small child, had always moved around because my father was in the Royal Canadian Air Force. And so somehow when I got here, I roosted.
Roosted, and you'd done watercolor painting and drawing early on, and then the pulp painting was another way to capture.
Well, it was mainly a way to enlarge the watercolors. The watercolors I were doing on Japanese paper, and they were all very small because if you made them large, they looked awful. They just looked like something for a greeting card. And also, I wanted the edges to disappear and blend. And that was very hard to do on a larger scale. I tried, but I never exhibited any of that work because it was total failure. But when I encountered the paper making, it was just totally felt completely right.
That's really cool.
And also, I really would have liked to have pursued a bit more Japanese paper making, but I did get to do two broadsides one both with Amanda Degner, one at the Minnesota Center for the Book Arts, and one here. And I thought that the Japanese inclusion methods were very interesting and kind of wonderful.
Right. Tell me a little bit about, you've used so many different commercial papers as well. Like, did you have a source, like a point person for ordering papers for printing or Japanese papers? Like, where did you?
Well, Japanese paper I tended to get from Yasutomo because they gave me good wholesale discounts.
Was that directly in Japan?
No, it was
They had
in San Francisco,
San
through
Francisco.
the San Francisco office. And that, so I got a number of papers, papers from them. Otherwise, before that, I'd always been buying from Andrews Nelson Whitehead.
Okay.
And then after that, pretty much, I mean, once in a while, there would be something that I would like from New York Central when they had good papers. They really had probably the most of anybody. And now you can get them from Dick Blick for a good price. You know, things like Bugra and that kind of paper. But mostly, I would say by once I got a chance to work with handmade paper, I was hooked. I got the MacArthur in 89, but even before that, when I had gone to England in 1987, I think it was, and they were closing down the mill, I took all the money that I had gotten from the Circus of Dr. Lau, and I bought paper. I still have, even
some of
now.
that. Which mill are you referring to in England?
Hale Mill.
Hale Mill.
Bartram Green,
yep,
Hale
yep.
Mill. And I bought paper that had linen content because people weren't making paper with linen content here at that point. And I bought, I think I bought the closeout of the Renaissance Four, which is made out of old British mail bags. And with that also the Nefertiti, which is the blue version. And I bought a lot of Renaissance II and toned repairing. And I must have bought about 4,000 or 5,000 sheets of DeWint. I bought it. So basically, I have not had to buy a lot of commercial paper other than if I wanted something fairly simple, get some arches cover, that kind of thing. Or, yeah, I would say the bulk of my handmade paper that is not decorated is from Bartram Green and from that time when I must have bought, I don't know, 15, 20,000 sheets of paper. But when you're a bookmaker, 1,000 sheets is, you can't even start a decent size book without 1,000 sheets. So, and I also bought the finale, not all of it, but most of it, which I made the watermark for Simon for the last paper that they did at Bartram Green. And that's the paper that we used for the book on Hale Mill.
Oh, right.
Yeah, was finale. So that was fun.
Yeah. Now tell me a little bit how you sold your work. You mentioned that you took the money from the sales of one of your pieces to buy all that paper.
Well, it was a big book.
Yeah.
That I sold for $450. And now, if you're lucky, you might get it for $5,000.
Right.
The Circus of Dr. Lau. Well, The main way that I ended up being able to build a base of customers was that after people stopped telling me that I was doing something frivolous, I would say in the mid-70s, then I would get invited to give talks. And I had enough work that I had done. I think the first talk might have been in 1975, and it was Doc Leslie had a program at the New York Public Library called Man in the Machine. Mm-hmm. And I think Stephen Harvard and Rocky Steinauer of the Steinauer Press recommended that I give a talk.
Was that the title of the lecture series?
Mm-hmm.
Man and the Machine? Was yours Woman and the Machine?
No.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Well, that's a whole other
I
subject.
know, I know. Yes, yes.
And one that keeping my overhead very low, living very primitively here, gives you freedom.
Yeah.
Being as a self-employed artist, you know that too.
Yes. So you were able to sell work. You started selling work through these events, and people started hearing
well,
about
they
you.
They would I would get a customer, you know,
yeah.
usually a standing order patron
okay.
institution.
Uh-huh.
And the highest number of standing orders I ever had was 50.
Okay.
And I'm down to about 40 now.
Mm-hmm.
And some institutions want you to bring it to them and show it to you, but it's not worth it to make truck down to New York City
Right.
to sell them one book. I mean, that's
Right.
not, it's not worth it for me. I
Right.
try to do everything economically.
Yeah.
And so, but I had a local photographer who took very good slides
Mm-hmm.
of my books and was willing to come here to the house and do that. And so I accepted all of those invitations to come and give a talk.
Right.
And of course, by then, I started to get a little recognition in 1978, or so, I think it was 78, yep. The Boston Public Library and the Wigan Gallery had an exhibition that went on during the a retrospective, a 25-year retrospective. I wonder if we'll have a 75-year
Yes.
retrospective.
Yeah, you
anyway,
better.
If I last that long. Anyway, and it was during the Boston Antiquarian Book Fair.
Okay.
And I met Tom Taylor and Charlie Silvezicki at those
Oh.
at that time. And both of those were very active and good booksellers.
Okay. So
So
they.
I've always, I have not had, I always, I mean, I know a lot of people now are making, you know, 30 copies of their books because they know that's what they can sell. It also raises the price way up. But I always felt that it was important not to get stuck in the situation of, say, the Allen Press, where all of their books were already spoken for. I wanted the books individually because I wanted them to go out and find their place in the world. Because my subject matter is all over the place. And certainly not, you know, it's like the Black Sparrow Press or something like that, where it's pretty consistent about what they're doing. And so with the 50 books, I would predicate the price on selling those at 30% off to recoup my out-of-pocket expenses making the book. Not wages for me, but out-of-pocket expenses. I tried to keep the prices as low as possible, and I still do that. And that money comes back and bankrolls the next book. And then when I sell what's beyond that, that's when I start to make wages.
Okay. And so what is a typical edition size?
Is 100 to
100.
150.
Okay. Right.
As some, I've done 200, like Hail
Right.
Mill, because I thought there would be, I mean, I still have about 30 of those, which is too many. But woven and interlocking book structures, we made 200 specials, and they're all gone. And the 2300 or 2100, I forget how much it was, many, oh, 2100 trade books, those are all gone. But the books available through archive.org to be downloaded for free now.
Yeah, this is woven and interlocking book structures, and it is a gem of interesting structures. Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to tell you about the Paper Year, my annual subscription club. It's kind of like a year-long online class and features a new paper project every month. Get inspired with video and written project instructions designed to spark ideas that keep you creating for the rest of the month. Explore creative paper techniques, including origami, pop-ups, paper weaving, book arts, paper cutting, and more. And join our growing community of paper lovers online to learn and share in a warm, encouraging, supportive, creative community. Visit HelenHebertStudio.com to find out more. Registration will open again April 1st, but you can hold your spot now. Now back to our conversation. I want to talk about that book and your unique book structures. And I don't know when you started those, but you mentioned the MacArthur Award. Let's just talk a little bit about that. I want to hear how you found out about it and any details you know you can share with a colleague.
I was in the bathtub.
Uh-huh.
And Tamara Schumann was here. And she said, there's a woman on the phone who called earlier. And I told her you were down cleaning the algae off the pond. And she, I think you should take the call.
Okay.
And so she brought the phone into me in the tub. And this woman said, hello, I'm so-and-so, president of the MacArthur Foundation. I would like you to know that that you have received a MacArthur. And I was sort of in a state of shock.
Mm-hmm.
She very nicely said, there was never any question in our minds that you, whether or not you would receive a MacArthur once you were nominated. And I would like you to call this number to be able to give your social security number to the office. And so Tamara brought me in a pencil and paper, and we took that number down.
Uh-huh.
And so then, and she said, yeah, you can call that number in a few hours. So I called the number, and I said, this is Claire Van Vliet. And they said, oh, yes. I said, maybe it's real. I said, oh, yes, like they've heard of me.
Right.
And so that's how I heard. I gave them my social security number. I was 50, I think 56 years old.
Okay.
There were 290. Our class completed 290 people had gotten it by that time. And in my class was the highest percentage of women. There were nine women.
Okay.
So that, which was nice.
Did you have any contact with the other recipients? Was there anything?
Oh, yes. They used to have, when there was not that many, they mm-hmm. used to have meetings that you could go to.
Okay.
In Chicago, fellowship meetings. And I went to, I think, four of those. It was wonderful.
Oh.
The people that I met, you know, and got to be friends with and all of that stuff. That was really great.
Right,
And to
right.
hear them talk and give presentations and things of that sort.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But the main thing that the MacArthur allowed me to do was to take time out and accept some things like the invitation to go to New Zealand and Australia and do that, because I went to New Zealand three times and Australia twice, and also allowed me to take a time off to do workshops and also to start printing some of my lithographs again. And in a sense, if I wasn't working on the books, the factory was closed. An interesting thing is that from 1955 until 1975, it was the books were really my hobby. I did a brisk business in selling print editions and worked for print publishers like Lakeside and Uum Graphic in Denmark, and there were a number of, and also in Norway, I was doing quite a few print editions, and there used to be from Ferdinand Roten and then Marston Graphics and then Lakeside Graphics, these very personable, knowledgeable print dealers that went around to schools and bookstores and museums and sold prints. I actually bought, I have a couple of Redons, a couple of Goyas that I bought from them, but they also had contemporary prints as well. But once they started doing the prints with the quite, you know, the celebrity artists, places like UAEL and Graphic Studio and all of Tamarind, all of these kinds of, the bottom kind of dropped out of the printmaking. Because prints all of a sudden moved into a very high-end product. And so at that point, the books started to, I had done enough of them and had enough standing orders slowly accumulating, that they were more steady income. And so the books were supporting my print habit. And that's still true.
Right. And how did you
the pulp paintings have always paid for themselves because, you know, they're pretty and they always did sell well when I had a gallery. Yeah.
Did you ever edition pulp paintings or were they all one of a kind?
The pulp paintings are editioned in the books.
Right. Okay.
And I always say to people, who am I to worry about doing a whole football field length of clouds, like which is what we ended up doing with Lilac Wind? I said, it's after all, El Greco painted 17 penitent St. Peters, some with and some without ivy. So I didn't have any trouble with repetition. And also with printmaking, it's true the dollar bills won't have to look alike, but that's engraving, and that's a whole other thing. You can really clean those plates, and it's done by machine. But when you're a printmaker, you try to make it, each one, exactly the same, but you never do quite. But the main thing is, does it have the right feeling? Somehow some of your glitches in printing have interfered with the communication, the visual communication, then okay, that's, but basically, you know, I was used to doing multiples.
Right.
I was happy doing multiples.
Right. And how did you move into the shaped books, the unique structures?
Well, the first shaped book was we did with the decal that we made for the shaped decal for Lilac Wind.
Okay.
But the idea of making the books, I do feel books should work in the hand.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really important. Being able to make the paper with a shaped decal is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously you could do that because Twin Rocker had these decals that they made envelopes with. So
right.
that already had occurred to me that that was totally possible. And of course, with styrofoam, it's so easy with this dent, not styrofoam, but the blue board from Dow Chemical. It comes in all kinds of thicknesses that will match very nicely on your decal.
Yes.
And then in 1980, I think it was 80, Terry Ballinger at Columbia Library School invited a whole bunch of people, paper makers, printmakers, printers, bookmakers.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked people to talk on various topics. My topic was ink, so I abdicated from it by inviting Mr. Powers from Van Sun Ink to explain to us the difference between rubber-based ink and oil-based ink. That was very illuminating. But Haiti Kyle came and showed us how to make a slipcase that was just all infolded and also covers. And then when I was out in San Francisco at one point giving a talk, I think it was the first Lieberman lecture for the American Printing History Association, and that was held at Mills, the late lamented Mills.
Yeah.
I met Betty Luchaika, and she was showing how you could have an accordion, but you could also have this slipped in, very clever slipped in spine.
Uh-huh.
So that kind of thing. But then the quilt books were something that really I got me going in terms of the structures. But the structures became possible, and this is one of the things we're going to be emphasizing at the Boston Athenaeum exhibition, is that it's not only that decorating paper has really enhanced all of our bookmaking, but also the handmade paper that's very structural and withstands an enormous amount of times to be folded
mm-hmm.
and unfolded.
Mm-hmm.
That really allowed the whole idea to percolate of getting rid of glue.
Right.
Glue is almost always damaging.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though there are less damaging glues now than there was before, but certainly hide glue and all of those glues are really. Yeah. So I started with the quilt books, and with Katie and Bernie, making these abacus strips that could be woven through. And they got more and more tight. And I've always advocated not making accordions that are where they have a cover on each end. So you basically have a slinky.
Right.
I've always advocated making a cover that wraps so that the accordion can be leafed through. just with something in your hand and doesn't become this awkward thing that runs away from you. And so basically those books could not have been made, the quilt books could not have been made without without the Twin Rocker and Katie and Bernie's abaca papers.
Right. And the abaca, I guess I haven't actually seen and held one of those books. Is I know abaca is very strong. I work with it. But is the paper, the strips that you are weaving through, is it thick on the thick side or is it fairly thin?
No, it should be, it can be like a 65-pound cover.
Okay.
If it gets heavier than that, its folding strength is not as good. You know, the thinner the paper, this as long as the fibers are not short,
yeah,
is really stronger. So I would say it probably calipers in maybe around 4 at the most, 5. Maybe it's text weight paper rather than, because what it's holding together is things that are single sheets of one sort and another, sometimes a double sheet in there. But, you know, paper's so terrific. Once you kind of can manipulate it through a slot and click it into place, it's there.
Right. Yeah.
You know? And so the quilt books, making the quilt covers, which were very illustrative of the text and a lot of fun for me to figure out how to have it be one thing on one side and something entirely different on the other. But the structures were made possible by this wonderful paper that both Twin Rocker, I mean, other people were probably doing it too, but the paper makers that I was working with right. Katie and Bernie and
Twin Rocker.
And Twin Rocker.
Yeah. And how did the woven and interlocking book structures come about?
Well,
that was published with Chronicle Books, is that right? Or was that a different publisher?
No, we published it ourselves.
You published it. Okay. Chronicle
yes.
did the trade publication of Sally's Lament. Right?
Yes, but yeah. That, you know, that's not a woven structure.
Right.
That I one of the things I realized is it the first time I realized that you've got to do production appropriate to the means of production was when I realized that I did not want to burden the Steinauer Press when we were doing the limited editions club edition of The Circus of Dr. Lau. And I said, I can't ask the Steinauer Press to do a Janus Press book. So that was a real revelation to me.
Yeah.
So I traded my fee for that book for the type and the permission from Viking, negotiated through Limited Editions Club, to make 150 copies of handmade book.
Oh.
So I thought, yeah, we're going to do two books. We're not going to try to do everything in one book. It doesn't have to be this way. So the same thing with this Aunt Sally's Lament is there was no way you could do a commercial version of the handmade Aunt Sally's Lament.
Right.
Oh, have you ever seen Sam's Sandwich?
No.
I think it's David Pelham.
Okay.
So I waltz in there to the Chronicle Books production room and I say, look at Sam's Sandwich. We can easily make this book if we do the same structure as Sam's Sandwich. And so Let's see, that we digressed. So what were we
Yeah,
on?
so let's go back. So to woven and interlocking book
Oh
structures.
yeah. Well, that I was invited to go to the first do a big workshop at the first New Zealand Book Symposium. And that was in, I think, 93. And one of the students in the class was Elizabeth Steiner. And Elizabeth had come up with some strip bindings that were really interesting, and had also done a version of the Aunt Sally's Lament original, to actually Haidee Kyle's kimono doll structure. And she had done one that was a round format on the Mareki boulders. And so I got Elizabeth and I were same age. We really clicked. And so a number of years later, as she developed more ideas of her strip bindings, I said, well, why don't we do a book? My part will be the accordions, and then we'll include your strips. And so that's how that came about. And then I developed the strip binding further with a number of the books that I've done since, because that was published, I think, in 2001. So, and Elizabeth came here a couple times. Like many New Zealanders, she's an intrepid traveler. And that was really a collaboration, and a collaboration of the two presses. The Steiner, her name's Elizabeth
Steiner.
Steiner, the Steiner Press and the Janus Press. So we kind of co-published it.
And yeah, that just rem I want to talk just briefly because we're running out of time here, but about sort of your live work model. So I read that you initially lived on this land with no running water and very primitive, right? And then you built where you're living now. And you have guest quarters. Does someone there all the time
No, I'm
working?
by
No, you're by
myself.
yourself.
I'm
But
by
a
myself.
lot of time you have people who come and work with you or
Well, not anybody resident anymore. But early on, we're resident. And one thing I want to make very, very, very clear is, except for one instance, which I was very unhappy about, nobody has ever worked for the Janus Press without being paid. I don't believe in internships.
Good
I
for
think
you.
everybody should be paid a fair wage for what they do. And as a friend of mine who had an MBA said, and I said, everybody gets paid more than me. And he said, yeah, but that it's your work. And I said, yeah, it's my work. So that's funny. I'm really fine with that. And also, it makes me not feel. I mean, some of the people who are staying here a long time who've worked with me, like Audrey worked with me for 25 years. She would still be working with me if she hadn't died. And Andrew's been working, as he said, 20 years is, if I think it's somebody who's going to work here a long time, I'm very. It's a step by step. I will give them projects to bring them up so that, I mean, he's a better printer than I am now. And so, particularly with the polymer plates, which I have printed, but I'm not as comfortable with them as I am with metal. And I always took under the after a while. I realized that Freeman Keith at the Steinauer Press was right. He says it's a lot easier to make a Vermonter into a printer than a printer into a Vermonter.
So you have met local people that have ended up.
Absolutely. Jim Bicknell was my binder 11 years. I worked with Nancy Southworth over the last 50 years.
Yeah.
And it's just, and Judy Conant and Mary Richardson, and they're all here.
Right. So you mentioned this show coming up at the Boston Athenaeum. Tell me a little bit about that and what anything else you're working on right now.
Well, that will be next fall, opening right at the Boston Athenaeum.
Fall 2024.
It'll open right after Labor Day, and we'll run through the year.
Okay.
2024. And its emphasis is going to be on paper. Both the decorative part of paper and the mechanical paper, allowing for all these structures, and also the fact that I've been integrating handmade paper and decorated paper into my printmaking editions. So that is pretty interesting, and also because the Janus Press is 70 years old this year.
Yeah.
And I've always pretty much printed at least one book a year, sometimes as many as five or six. It's nice to take an aspect of the books and the work and concentrate on it. And since I'm sort of in love with paper, I feel like I'm the person who's, I used to be she who dies with the most yarn wins. I feel like now she who dies with the most paper wins, because there's still a lot of paper here, which I will not live to print on all of it, I'm sure. So the Boston Athenaeum show is really, really interesting to me, that's what it's concentrating on.
And now how is that curated, if you will? Like, how involved are you? You're working with someone there, but
they have a complete collection of the Janus Press, which was given to them by one of their board members.
Okay.
And so they even have the broadsides. I mean, they really have a complete collection. And so it's a matter for them also of celebrating this collection that they just received. And so I think there will be a publication. I mean, that's the plan. And the curating is going to be done by John Buchtel, who is the is their rare book curator, or director, or whatever. And very, very knowledgeable. He taught the history of the book with Mark Diminution at Rare Book School for 19 years.
Right.
So I have complete confidence in what he's going to both write and what he's pick. He's already picked a lot of it. So and then as far as what I'm working on cleaning up my back trail at this point, this winter, and also working on finishing some of the variable editions of my prints. But there are a couple of books that probably will work on, but I'm not sure. I mean, I'm satisfied with us if the Erratus book, which Andrew and I co-published, Plowboy Press and Janus Press, is the last book, that's okay.
Right.
Because actually I'm 90, and it could happen at any time.
Oh, what a wonderful life you have and have had. Yeah.
Very, very, very lucky.
Very lucky. Yeah. Well, and thank you for all your contributions to the world. My goodness.
Well,
wonderful.
It's only passing on what other people, with Mr. Anderson, who I apprenticed with, he was amazing and taught me so much. And then somebody like Haiti Kyle, all her wonderful ideas opened my mind. And then Kathy and Howie Clark opening this door to paper making. It's just, I've had a lot of wonderful opportunities.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I totally get that. I feel like the same. So maybe we'll end talking about the name Janus Press, because I know it has something to do with looking back, looking forward.
Well,
Does that relate at all in your mind to what you were just saying?
Well, it was chosen by my first husband, Ralph Johnson, W.R. Johnson, a classicist. And he, I think he thought of it in terms of balance, apparently during the Renaissance, because Janus can look forward and backward at the same time. He symbolized balance.
Yeah.
And it's also the rising and setting of the sun and the moon, which I didn't realize, but it's also imagery that I'm hooked on.
Yeah.
And also on innovation, but the innovation happening within tradition.
Tradition, yeah.
One
yeah.
of the things I've felt particularly about the books is if I give you a book or you get a book from me, I would like to think it could go onto a bookshelf out of the way without damaging its neighbors. Because some of its neighbors are certainly going to be better books than mine. So, I mean, if you can buy a really good incunable for less than you can buy some of these books that we're making now, you have to wonder what's going on with the world.
Right, right.
So anyway, I think of Janus as kind of always searching for a proper place. Not being too self-important. The middle.
Yeah, the middle. Oh,
yeah,
good.
Balance.
Okay. Okay.
Balance.
Okay. And you mentioned Katie McGregor's coming by
shortly
here.
Today.
What are you guys working on? Something for Hand Paper Making magazine?
We are. We're Katie made the cover papers for the Erotus book. And she pulp painted them. And because she's so conscientious, she's made about twice as much paper as she needed.
Right.
And so we said, well, gosh, wouldn't this be nice to have in hand paper making? And you do have to have 1,250 pieces of paper. Have you done it?
Small pieces.
Okay.
I think I did it once. Yeah.
These are going to be 3x6.
Okay, that's generous. Yeah.
Well, I think in order to,
to see it. Yeah.
Yeah. And
so you're cutting them today.
She's bringing some of the overs. And we're going to sort them. And I have already some of the overs. So we're going to sort through them and find out which sheets are appropriate. And so she'll be here for a couple of days. And she's also bringing press.
Oh, right. The little
press
back. Are you intending to make small sheets again then?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And book covers. Yeah.
Covers. Yeah.
Definitely.
Right.
Yeah. That's part of my cleanup campaign. There's an awful lot of unfinished business here.
Oh, and yeah, I get it. I'm not, I'm approaching 60 and I'm starting to sort of try to clean things up, yeah, and tidy
Well,
up,
some
yeah.
friends of mine that are two spouses, widows, one's a widower and one's a widow, of artists are actually going to yesterday had a bonfire of
Oh,
all
gosh.
the unfinished work that got left behind. So by their spouses. So I'm trying to minimize the size of the bonfire.
Do you have a plan for your
I
archive, your personal archive, or is this something already in
well,
place?
the papers up to about 10 years ago went to the University of Vermont.
Okay.
I would assume they probably, these, what's here now would go there.
Yeah.
The design archive, the bulk of it is at the Library of Congress. And they also have a pretty complete collection of the prints as well as the books.
Well, Claire, thank you so much for coming on the show. And yeah, it's been a real treat talking to you.
Thank you. Well, the same to you, Helen.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.
There's a reason besides the season, the main contain